from the Mutual Broadcasting System. This is STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. Now, retired Marine Intelligence Officer and globally recognized risk expert, Hal Kempfer.
Welcome to STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk, and I'm going to be covering a couple things I've hit on in the past, but I got to tell you, a lot of stuff has been happening. I'm going to talk about what's going on with Venezuela and the Caribbean, and I'm going to talk about what's happening with Ukraine, Russia, the U.S., the Europeans, all of it focused on the war in Ukraine and potentially ending the war in Ukraine. And I will say that we're at a couple of strategic inflection points in both of those issues, and there's enormous things that could happen very soon, one way or another. So I'm kind of going through what's been going on and then talk about what could happen. All right. Now, Venezuela right now is dealing with immense U.S. military diplomatic pressure. This last weekend, President Trump unilaterally declared that Venezuelan airspace is closed. In case you're wondering, the U.S. president nor the United States, or neither the U.S. president nor the United States, really has the power to close another country's airspace. But as we have a carrier task force sitting off the coast and a lot of other things, putting a notice like that to any airline around the world is basically saying, you really don't want to fly in here because something really bad could happen to you. And what he basically told the airlines, and he said to the airlines, pilots, drug dealers, and human traffickers to consider the airspace above and around Venezuela to be closed in its entirety. And he put this out on his Truth Social media post. I guess that's how we do things anymore, is that the president puts out U.S. foreign policy on Truth Social. That's kind of interesting. When asked if the warning meant an imminent airstrike is going to happen in Venezuela, Trump said, don't read anything into this. Well, I'm going to tell you, I'm looking at that thing. I don't know that you can avoid not reading something into it. It's pretty clear what it's saying. It's an interesting tactic. And again, while Venezuelan airspace is sovereign Venezuelan territory, certainly any airline, any international airline, would be crazy not to heed this. Now, is this exceptional? Have we never done something like this before? No, we've done this. I don't know how many times we've done it in the past, but you know, we've been in wars in the Middle East and around the world, and usually before we're contemplating military action involving airstrikes and a lot of aviation activity, we will, as a cautionary note, we'll put a note out there to various airlines and others that they need to avoid that airspace in order to minimize the chance of collateral damage. So that's not an exceptional thing. But I find it fascinating. This is a tactic I've seen with President Trump before, that he can say something, or he does say something, and it causes a huge reaction, and he doesn't actually have to follow up with any immediate action right afterwards. I'm not saying there won't be action, but that followed up. Now, what do we have down there? What's in the Caribbean? We have a significant task force. We have an aircraft carrier, actually an entire aircraft carrier task force, Gerald R. Ford. That is our most advanced aircraft carrier. It has our most advanced aircraft launch system that can significantly increase the sortie rate, the amount of flights that an aircraft carrier can launch and recover and rearm and send back up at any given time. So that's there. That carries normally a complement of about 70 to 90 aircraft. I'm not sure. I've heard 70 used for what it has right now, but it could be upgunned with more. And of course, there's an F-35 squadron at Roosevelt Roads that is up in Puerto Rico that's been flying. My understanding is there's other aircraft that are flying in and out of Roosevelt Roads as well, which doesn't surprise me. And that was a naval station that we used for many, many years. It was closed after the Cold War, but apparently the airfield is still viable, still usable, and it is now currently being used as a military airfield. And we have flown a variety of aircraft, strategic bombers in and around the area, to include more recently a B-52, I think one or two B-52s, and that was pretty much signaling to the Venezuelans that the U.S. has a lot of capabilities to do things. We can do airstrikes, missile strikes. Potentially, if a ship got close enough, we could do naval gunfire. We also have a Marine Expeditionary Unit, the 22nd MEU, out of Camp Lejeune, primarily out of Camp Lejeune area. And then the Amphibious Ready Group that carries that MEU afloat. And so that's sitting off the coast, which gives us a variety of things we can do in the special operations realm, in the amphibious raid realm and stuff. We don't have an invasion force sitting right off the coast. I know there's a lot of thinking that the U.S. is going to repeat what it's done in the Middle East and invade and try and take over the country. But that's actually not the array of forces we have down there. But it is an array of forces that can do a lot of things. All right. And there's a very real threat that Maduro faces, which is covert operations, which may not be as covert as usual, since President Trump publicly said that he greenlit, so to speak. I don't think he used the term greenlit, but that he had given the okay for the CIA to conduct covert operations in Venezuela. It does get into the definition of the term covert operations when everybody knows you're doing it. But what this does is it keeps Maduro guessing. And even if we're not doing covert operations, he's going to be looking over his shoulder. He's obviously worried that wherever he is could be blown up by an airstrike. Any vehicle he's would travel in could get hit with an airstrike. And he's obviously very concerned if he was to get in a plane and fly someplace, that could get taken down. So he's obviously very worried. And then he's looking around him at his generals and all these others, his security staff, and wondering, has the CIA paid somebody off, or they promised something, and maybe one of them is thinking about taking an active role in the end of the Maduro regime, so to speak. So he's got to be worried about that as well. All right. Now, Trump says he recently spoke to Maduro, and he basically said, you and your family need to get out of, and I don't think he said if you know what's good for you, but that would be the kind of language that I would expect, something if not stated, certainly implied in that regard. Maduro reportedly put a bunch of conditions. He says, I still want to retain control of the military forces. I don't know how he would do that for a practical matter. And he wants a worldwide amnesty from prosecution. And that's something I don't think the President of the United States can actually grant. And, you know, we could influence, but we certainly couldn't grant it. So right now, that appears to be on hold. But it was fascinating that he was actually even, it sounds like Maduro may have even been pondering the idea of his exit, and I find that rather a fascinating proposition. Now, the U.S. has put itself in a difficult position. You know, we have this Operation Southern Spear. It's a joint task force that was stood up under U.S. Southern Command. A Southern Spear is out there that's basically taking the lead for these targeting of the boats and semi-submersibles that are carrying drugs out of Venezuela and also carrying drugs on the other side of the Pacific as well. And this is one where we identify it as a drug boat, a boat carrying narcotics, dangerous narcotics. We take it out. And what's fascinating is that we named a number of drug cartels throughout Latin America as terrorist organizations. Narco-terrorists, and more recently we named the Cartel de los Soles, which is the Cartel of the Sun. The sun actually refers to the stars that general officers have in the rank insignia, and that cartel is seen as being effectively led by Maduro and many of his general officers. His security military apparatus actually run that cartel. Venezuela is not a drug-producing nation, although they do have certainly drug laboratories that process cocaine and other narcotics that may come into Venezuela. But they have made a big economic play for many years as basically the place you want to ship out of, because the government will enable the cartels to ship their product freely. There's no fear of any enforcement effort that would stop the cartels from shipping their product around the world. They can launch fast boats out of there. They can launch semi-submersibles out of there. And those semi-submersibles can run up into the Caribbean, usually, or the fast boats. Usually with the fast boats, they'll go up there, hit an island. Everything gets transferred over on the island, and then they'll move it up another way. And eventually, you create such a diffusion of transit modes, if you will, that at some point it's difficult to track where it is and how it's coming in. A lot of the fast boats, so overcome that gap, that daring gap in the South America, south part of Panama, where there's no roads, there's no railroads, anything. And so it's very difficult to transport drugs or heavy loads over land because there is no way to do it. So the way everybody does is they do it by sea. They go around it. And what they'd use is the fast boats to go around it. They also use the semi-submersibles to go around it, offload it in Central America or up in Mexico, and then it gets taken up to the border and brought over, many cases brought over by clandestine tunnels that the cartels run under the U.S. border. So that's kind of how that's going. But at some point there, as you're probably figuring out, most of the drugs have to travel by water. And so that's why the U.S. has taken out what I would call the supply chain, a critical supply chain node, which is targeting the boats or the maritime vessels, however they're, you want to describe it, and taking them out. And of course, because we've designated them terrorist targets, we're handling those things, we're dealing with those the same way we would deal with any other terrorist target anywhere in the world, whether it's Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, or whatever. If we see it's a terrorist target, we take action, we take it out. And that's what we are doing with that designation. All right. But the U.S. is kind of stuck. We've got this huge array of forces sitting off the coast of Venezuela. We do not recognize Maduro as legitimately elected. We think he lost by two-thirds. Two-thirds of the electorate voted for the opposition. He maintained power through the use of force and coercion. But we don't see him as a legitimate government in Venezuela. And we clearly will want to see him leave. We got a $50 million bounty on his head, and we want him out of there. And so we need to see Maduro leave. And if he doesn't leave, with the array of forces we have there, we pretty much have to act. And if we don't act, we're going to look very bad. If we put a carrier task force and an amphibious ready group with a Marine Expeditionary Unit sitting offshore, and we've made all these threats that we've made, and then at some point we just walk away and leave Maduro in place, Maduro is going to claim victory. Everybody backing Maduro, to include Iran and countries you wouldn't think of, Russia, others, we'll sit there and say the U.S. was a paper tiger, that we make threats, but we don't follow through. And for President Trump personally, there is a phrase out there that involves his name and the term chicken out, all right, or chickening out as an expression. And it would be seen that he was, you know, to use a famous Texas phrase, all hat, no cattle. In other words, he went up there and then he backed down from the fight. And that would be a grave problem for the U.S. because that would reflect on everything we want to do after Venezuela. So we're kind of stuck. We probably have to do something. We'll probably have to do airstrikes. We may very well feel compelled to do something on the ground as well. Not an invasion, but something like a raid or something like that on the ground. So we pretty much have to do that. Now, his security forces, his military are very much aligned to him being in power. And unless our clandestine covert effort can somehow separate him and his regime from the interests of some of his security forces folks, we have to assume that they are going to, even if the opposition was to come to power, that there might be a full-blown civil war going on down there. And so that's a big problem. Now, I should finally mention that there's another issue that's floating around. And that's widely reported, and that Secretary of War or Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth, early on in the targeting of drug boats, had given an order where he said there should be no survivors. That is very problematic. Now, I heard yesterday that President Trump said that Hegseth had denied, I think it was yesterday or this morning, that he had denied that he had actually given that order, but officers, apparently, according to reports, had believed that that was the order they had been given by the Secretary of Defense or the Secretary of War. And so they hit a boat, and then they did a second strike to take out survivors that might be in the water. And generally speaking, under international law, Hague, Geneva, and the war, the laws of armed conflict, there are certain circumstances where a combatant is no longer a combatant. For example, I was a paratrooper. If I'm flying into the battle, if you will, whether I'm in the plane or under canopy or on the ground, I am always a lawful target. under the laws of armed conflict, all right? Even though I'm in a parachute, there's not a whole lot I can do, you were allowed to shoot at me because I am a threat. I am coming in to attack, all right? Now, if I was a jet pilot, if I was fighting flying a fighter bomber or something like that, and I punch out, while I'm under canopy, I'm not supposed to be targeted. All right. I am no longer considered a combatant because I am now somebody who is just trying to, my weapon of war, if you will, is that fighter bomber, and I have now abandoned that, so I am no longer a threat. Now, if I get on the ground and start shooting, yeah, I'm back being a combatant again. But they're not supposed to target me in the air. Going back further was the issue of survivors of torpedoes, bombings and stuff, that they jump ship, they're in the water, they're either swimming or on life rafts or whatever. Can you go and kill them? You're not supposed to kill them. That is a violation of international war. Now, if I come up to rescue them and they start opening fire on me, could I return fire? Absolutely. You bet. But but as far as that international law is concerned, it's a search and rescue issue. And depending on the circumstances, I'm not obliged to have to rescue them. You know, there was a thing where they said, oh, you have to go out there and rescue them. And it was brought up, well, submarines don't have the ability to do that. They operate under the water. They have very limited space, very limited capability. They can't really take prisoners. And so there's not an absolute requirement that I always rescue them, but I'm not supposed to go and hit them again. And that's what Secretary Hegseth's order has kind of implied, is that he ordered them to target folks who are in a protected status, that they're not combatants currently. And there is an argument to be made. They're terrorists, so as terrorists, they're always a threat or whatever. But it is something that will definitely be worked out, something they're going to look at. And I would say in years hence, you know, we're already seeing the Senate Armed Services Committee reviewing this matter, and I imagine that this is going to become a bigger issue over time. All right. Next, I want to discuss what's happening with Ukraine. President Trump put out a 28-point peace plan. All right. As someone somewhat said rather snarkily, it reads better than the original Russian. And the reason they say that is because it looks just like what the Russians were kind of throwing out there, which is surrender your territory, shrink your military, government has to leave office, and leave yourself wide open for another Russian invasion. And I would point out that Putin has never found an agreement that he wouldn't violate. Whatever comes out of this is really, at most, an extended ceasefire agreement, but it is not going to be a full peace agreement because Putin doesn't understand peace. Putin understands taking territory. He understands the need for victory because he can't manage his economy. Can't manage his economy out of a wet paper bag. I mean, that guy is a horrible macroeconomic leader of a country. He's really bad. And their country is in a lot of trouble. But he's very accomplished in his human intelligence skills and trying to recruit people to do things and stuff like that. And he can be very personable and everything. So anyway, long story, the U.S. ended up taking what was pretty much a Russian position. Obviously, this threw the Europeans, Ukraine up in the air. What are they going to do? So there was meetings in Geneva between the U.S. and the Ukrainians. There were meetings in Abu Dhabi between the U.S. and the Russians. Steve Witkoff going up to Moscow, meet with them. And then the Ukrainians came over to Florida and met with Secretary Rubio again and some other members. Army Secretary Driscoll has been playing a big role in this. He went up to meet up to Geneva, is my recollection. And he met with the Ukrainians up there. And then he went up to Kyiv, not to Geneva. He met with the team that was in Geneva that went back to Kyiv in Ukraine and met with them in Ukraine. Anyway, it is a flurry of diplomatic activity. And there's supposed to be another big meeting with President Trump deciding what he's going to do, a variety of different things. But anyway, all this is going on. So that's what's been happening there. I don't know if they're any closer. You know, they keep having these meetings where they're poles apart, as far as I can tell, in terms of agreeing on very critical issues. And then they come out and say, we had a very positive, constructive meeting. You know, and some of the big things they just can't agree on at all are, you know, restricting the size of Ukraine's military forces or giving up territory to the Russians that the Russians have not taken militarily on the battlefield. And so that's a big problem. Now, after the Geneva meetings, they said it's kind of out there that They dropped from 28 to like 19 points. I don't know. Nobody's not quite sure what the 19 points are. But apparently part of this, though, involves regime change. And that's the regime change in Ukraine. And that's that Ukraine have elections. And that's going to be a kind of interesting thing because parts of Ukraine are obviously occupied by the Russians. So that means potential Ukrainian voters have been assimilated into Russia because they assimilated those oblasts and they've said that those are Russian citizens. So those voters would not be able to vote in a Ukrainian election. And so it would be a smaller part of the overall population, not a disrepresentation or non-representational part of the population, but that's a big deal. Ukraine's been under martial law since it was invaded in February 2022. And so President Zelensky has stayed in power. But this apparently is something that they're actively discussing. Putin wants, the charismatic Zelensky, he wants him out because he sees him as a galvanizing force for resistance against the Russian military, which he is. Now, Zelensky's dealing with a big corruption scandal. His chief of staff was forced to resign. His chief of staff goes way back with him, back when he was an actor and he was basically a producer, director in that field and followed him into politics and eventually into being his chief of staff as president. He's been very influential. I understand he's a very tough negotiator. And so his loss is certainly felt as a political blow to Zelensky. It also shows that this corruption scandal is getting very close to Zelensky. So that's definitely overshadowing all the negotiations. With all that said, based on what's being said right now, there are significant reasons to believe that they may be coming together with some sort of deal. I don't know if Putin keeps going back to his maximalist demands, but whatever they come up with the Ukrainians may not be acceptable to Putin. But there are some things. There are reports coming out that Putin has been doing what Putin always does, which is to promise the sun, the moon, the stars to the U.S. if we will abandon Ukraine. And that may have been received very well by Witkoff. And there's been reports that Witkoff was actually coaching the Russians in October on how to convince President Trump to go along with what they wanted to do. That is a very disturbing thing when our own emissary is coaching a foreign power on how to basically get over on our own president, who is his direct boss. Trump is not taking action on that. But very disturbing. And there's also discussion that there are those around Trump, to include Steve Witkoff and others, maybe some of his family members. They're looking at personal economic gain, business opportunities, dealing with the Russians, and basically throw the Ukrainians, that they would have a vested interest in essentially throwing the Ukrainians under the bus, so to speak. And so all these things are really concerning. And then one of the things in the 28-point plan was that the U.S. would somehow get a big chunk of those frozen Russian assets. And that's something the Europeans primarily control. And I don't think the Europeans, as much as this plan has kind of bypassed completely the Europeans, that particular point is something that it can't bypass the Europeans because the Europeans control it. So I don't know exactly what's happening, although Zelensky has talked a number of times about they need to do some of those frozen assets. They need those frozen assets. And so we'll see if those come over. But the Europeans are feeling that the U.S. kind of, circumvented them. And there are very great concerns in European capitals that the U.S. may be slackening its commitment to NATO. And that reflects that things, Taiwan is probably looking at this saying, would he cut a deal with Xi in China and leave Taiwan hanging in the wind? So there are a lot of strategic implications from what's happening right now that go well beyond whatever will occur this next week or two. Anyway, much to consider going forward. And thanks for listening to Strat. Thanks for listening to a little strategic risk assessment talk. Thank you for looking at finding Strat wherever you have it. We have it on all sorts of different platforms out there. We also have Hal Kempfer TV on the YouTube. We have stratpodcast.com. And of course, you can always go to my corporate website at www.gripsa.com and find out what else I'm doing. So thanks, and hope you enjoyed this one, and hope you listen to the next one.